This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Assassinations, killings, conspiracies, and crimes. We have a vague idea of all of this. There's a feeling, a sense that there's something more behind many of these stories. The Lincoln assassination, the Kennedy assassination, on and on. What are the plots, the politics, and the powers behind these history-changing murders? Well, Nick Redfern, who is often on this program, is back with us with a really arresting book called Assassinations, The Plots, Politics, and Powers Behind History-Changing Murders. It glued me to my seat. Nick is the author of numerous books. That is an understatement. Secret History, Conspiracies from Ancient Aliens to the New World Order, Area 51, The Revealing Truth of UFOs, Secret Aircraft, Cover-Ups, and Conspiracies, The Bigfoot Book, The Alien Book, Guide to ETs on Earth. He has been on In Search of Monsters, the History Channel, I'm sure, BBC's Out of This World, Proof Positive on Sci-Fi. In other words, he's been around. He's been on Ancient Aliens. And Nick, welcome back to Dreamland is all I can say.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Whitley.
Well, we've been doing Dreamland together for such a long time and have had such a great amount of fun and fascinating time doing it. What information? I often wonder, it seems to me like you write a book in the time it takes down to takes to sit down and write a book. It just amazes me. Now, we're going to talk today, folks, about a lot of different things. We're going to get into the Jim Forrestal story. You remember him? He died in May of 1949. We're not going to do that right away, but it was a very mysterious death, and he was aware of all of the UFO stuff that was unfolding at that time. And then Danny Calasaro, who died in 1991, he was investigating a cabal known as the Octopus. And it's not in here, but I am going to ask Nick what he thinks about the Lolita Express and the murder of Jeffrey Epstein, or the suicide of Jeffrey Epstein. I don't really know which. In fact, let's just get started with that. Are you aware of any of that? Have you studied it at all? Researched it?
I didn't really include that in the book, mainly because the time frame of writing the book.
Well, you couldn't have, but I wondered if you just knew and aware of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm aware of it, and you know, saw it on the news, but I haven't actually actively looked into that at all.
Okay, well, it worries me a lot because he dies, and all of those videotapes of all of those powerful people just quietly disappear into the woodwork. Where are they? Who owns those people now? I ask this question frequently on this show because somebody does. Okay, but that's not what we're going to be talking about today. Let's start with going a kind of roundabout way. Microwaves. I have a very personal reason for asking you about the significance of microwaves. Could microwaves kill?
Well, they can, yes. I mean, particularly when you're talking about the issue of microwaves in terms of, you know, killing a person, certainly there's no doubt that you know, sort of applied directed microwaves at a person can cause incredible problems to people. And this is actually one of the things I talk about in the book in regards to a very strange story that in ufology that a lot of people have probably never heard of. And it actually involves a guy named Arthur Bryant. who in the 1960s had sort of a classic contactee type of UFO encounter. He lived at the time in the southwest of England, in a huge air expanse of moorland called Dartmoor, which for people, if they want to sort of have an imagery in their mind, it's where Conan Doyle wrote and set The Hound of the Baskervilles. And it was that area where he lived. And he had this sort of classic, as I said, contactee encounter. Now, over the years, there's a lot of rumors have surfaced that the encounter that Bryant had was essentially a setup, if you like, and that Bryant was an unwitting guinea pig in an experiment to try and determine how the human mind could be altered and manipulated and to fabricate UFO events. And so the story is that microwave technology was used to affect his mind, but it went too far and it caused him to have a brain tumor. And he did die about 18 months after his encounter from an extremely aggressive extremely aggressive brain tumor. And which it was shown to have been caused by microwaves, but nobody could figure out why until in the late 1970s, early 80s, the rumors began to surface that he'd been sort of selected for this dicey and dangerous experiment to see how the mind could be altered and changed.
Well, the reason that interests me so much is that I had an incident happen a few years ago now, here in my apartment, where I suddenly became overwhelmed with a desire to commit suicide, which, I mean, actually, Annie had died, and I was pretty depressed. I can't say that it, you know, I might not have thought, I did think things like that right after she died, of course, and you would, and everyone does when they're, you know, a close marriage. One of the hardest things is for the survivor to continue on, and however, something very odd happened later that night. I mean, I just accepted it as part of my grieving process. I had no intention of doing it. Then, to my horror, one of the people who lived downstairs shot himself.
Wow.
And I thought, is this a coincidence or not? And I've asked many people about this because there are certainly have to be elements out there that I don't know about who might like to off Whitley Strieber. I mean, I talk about things and I write about things that I know for a fact there are people who do not want me to write about and talk about because some of them have told me that to my face. And I just wonder how extensive do you think that this technology is? Is it? Am I dealing with a coincidence, as I well may be? Or could it have been some kind of technology being used?
Well, I mean, a lot of people might say, well, that's coincidence. But there actually is a perfect example that sort of really goes sort of parallel to what you're talking about. And I have two chapters on this particular issue in the book.
Right.
And it all revolves around literally dozens of deaths in the UK of scientists and technicians who were working for Marconi at the time. This was the 1980s. And a lot of them were contracted out from the UK to work on President Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, as it was known. And quite literally, 32 employees of Marconi between 1981 and 1993 were found dead under extremely weird circumstances, and which appeared to look like suicides, like, for example, you know, somebody just getting in the car in the garage and putting a hose pipe, you know, through the exhaust and through the window.
Well, that's right. If I had done it, it would have been a suicide, no question. But it would not have been it wouldn't have been me. I would have been induced if I'm right about what happened.
Yeah, you're right. And but these quote, suicides were so weird and strange that you'd have to wonder why somebody would go to those lengths. For example, there was one scientist who just went to work or was going to work and suddenly stopped his car, got out of the car, took a rope out of the car, which we don't know why he even had the rope, and put one part of the tie part of the rope around a lamppost and the other part around his neck, and then hit the accelerator of the car and decapitated himself.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
That's not suicide. I don't know what to call it.
It's almost like self-murder.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say, self-murder. Yeah.
But one of the weirdest stories was, again, one of these scientists who killed himself in his garage, but instead of sitting in the car, which I guess is how most suicides in that situation are found, when the police were alerted because, you know, all the carbon monoxide was coming out of the garage, when the police opened the door, they couldn't find him. And they were just baffled for about 10 minutes. And it was only when they looked underneath the car, they saw that he was actually laid out on the concrete below the car, which, I mean, who would even think about doing that if you're going to kill yourself, you know, that you would lay yourself underneath the car?
These people were something, and it's too many. Something was being done to them.
Well, one of the intriguing aspects of all this is that a number of the scientists and technicians reported a significant memory loss where, for example, perhaps 2 days earlier, was completely gone from their mind. They just could not figure what had happened to them and why they had that memory loss. And so one of the theories is that they were possibly used in simple terms, sort of like a mind control operation where, you know, somebody was directed, if you like, to kill themselves. You know, in one sense, it would be a murder, but it would be a murder by your own hand. You would have no control over it. But I find that angle of many of those personnel having significant memory loss and not sure what had happened in the days that led up to when they actually killed themselves.
So they were reporting memory loss before they killed themselves.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've had two experiences in my life of vocalization transmitted into my brain via microwaves. The first time was done by the visitors, and I was already aware of this technology. It's a sort of open secret at this point, and it was even all those years ago that there was a technology that could induce sounds in the brain using microwaves. And it wasn't too much of a stretch for me to think that the visitors who might have a more sophisticated system were able to induce voices. So that didn't surprise me. But then later, a few years later, I was in bed in my apartment taking an afternoon nap in San Antonio in a ground floor apartment, and suddenly I heard a voice in my head, very sinister voice, saying that they were going to kidnap me. And it was no question immediately in my mind what was going on, that there was somebody nearby in projecting the voice. So I leaped up out of bed, ran out onto the screened-in porch, and there these two guys were standing right beside the building with a little device, a little silver device in the hand of one of them. And they ran off and jumped. They looked shocked to their core by my appearance, believe me. If I had my gun, I would have blasted them both. But I didn't have it. I didn't grab it in time. Anyway, they jumped in a black Mustang and drove away. And that never occurred again.
Wow.
So, but, you know, it's very real. Is the reason I bring it up. This is very real, and it's used and obviously abused. And now, when we get back, Free Dreamlanders, I'm going to ask them, why in particular is there any pattern to what happened to these Marconi scientists? What they were all working on, or is it random, or what exactly happened? We'll be right back. This is a commercial about a subscriber interview that we did back in 2008 with Jim Mars as the host, where the possibility that Saudi princes were involved in assassinations around the world is discussed. That was in 2008. Now, in 2020, the situation is much more open, and there seems to be a real possibility that this is going on. UnknownCountry.com is a place where you hear it first. Listen to this.
He's the one that, when he was caught in Pakistan, then the then White House press secretary, Ari Fleischer, said, he's the top al-Qaeda chief that we've caught to date, and we're going to make him talk. Well, they did. They tortured him, but it didn't work. So then they tricked him by making him think that they were bringing in Saudi interrogators who, you know, with the idea that he'd think they would stop at nothing and he would get scared and he'd tell them what they want to know. And instead, he was very relieved and said, well, thank goodness you guys are here, and proceeded to tell them that he was actually working for three Saudi princes. And
right.
That their cutout was an Air Marshal Mir of Pakistan.
As a subscriber, you'll get access to every Dreamland recorded, hundreds of subscriber interviews, access to live chats with celebrity guests, and our vibrant subscriber community. We believe that this is by far the best offering of its kind on the Internet. So go to unknowncountry.com and click on that subscribe tab right now.
As always, Dreamland's theme music is The O of Pleasure from Ray Lynch's beautiful album, Deep Breakfast, available at raylynch.com. We're talking to Nick Redfern, his new book, Assassinations, The Plots, Politics, and Powers Behind History-Changing Murders. And, you know, in this time of such turmoil, it's interesting to sort of rewrap our minds around the hidden underside of this world of ours. So let's get back to the Marconi scientists. What is there a pattern there? Were they all working on something, a similar part of the project, or do you know?
Well, Marconi has gone through various sort of incarnations and combinations with other companies over the years. But basically, Marconi does a lot of sort of high-tech technology for the military and so on. And for example, there's Marconi space and defense systems and underwater technology as well. So, you know, they're at the cutting edge of technology. But when all of this went on, which was from the very early 1980s through to round about 1993, many of them were working on President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative. And a lot of the work, it was done in the UK, but it was done by using like a US project, if you like. And what's particularly intriguing is the time frame, because not only was this the period when Reagan was sort of, you know, really trying to get this SDI program going ahead, it was the same time frame when he was talking about how, you know, the Earth could be united if we were faced with an extraterrestrial threat, which he mentioned in four or five lectures and speeches over the period, you know, in the mid-1980s. So I kind of find it intriguing that the Marconi scientists working on SDI were sort of dropping like flies at the same time that Reagan was talking about UFOs and an alien threat.
Well, Reagan and his wife had a close encounter of the third kind on Mulholland Drive here in Los Angeles on a way to a party in before he was in politics. And he, to his among their friends, they used to say that they left for the party Democrats and arrived Republicans. They saw a light, big light on the roadside up there on the drive and stopped to look at it. They got out of the car and looked at it and got back and drove to the party, and they were 45 minutes late. They never could account for that time. But then later, I think they did read. I know they read my book, Communion, and they read, I think they read a lot about, they probably, Nancy especially, would have read and known a lot of the UFO stuff. And I think they probably suspected that they had had a missing time experience. They may have even made efforts to find out more. I have no idea about that. But in any case, this was a man who was directly involved. And the Strategic Defense Initiative was a threat, conceivably, to the visitors. And I've often wondered, we're going to be talking about the Challenger in a little while, and I've often thought to myself, what if its name was the problem? We just don't know things like that. Anyway, so let's go on and just in conclusion of this section of the show, SDI, what happened to it? It failed. That's what happened to it. Mm-hmm. We don't have it. Now Trump is trying again, but it's a completely different system. It's a system that's very specifically designed to destroy satellites, it has nothing to do with any, as far as I know, with anything that might be like pulsed beam weapons or anything like that. So it's more, in other words, it's more Earth domestic, if you will, than SDI was. Okay, so now I want to roll back to, since we're in this subject of SDI, and we're sort of talking about the visitor angle a little bit, to bring up the Kennedy assassination. And why don't you give us, there are some very interesting and strange stories about, let's start with Dorothy Kilgallen, who, oddly enough, was some members of my family knew Dorothy Kilgallen. And when she came to Texas to meet Jack Ruby, she had dinner with them. But anyway, tell the story.
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole JFK assassination issue is sort of, deeply complex, with a lot of different strands and angles and connections. And, there's so many people who died under controversial situations in relation to the Kennedy assassination. But Dorothy Kilgallen, she may have lost her life because she really was, an extremely good investigative journalist. I think for a lot of people, they remember for her TV shows and things like this. But she actually was, not just a, somebody who wrote about gossip and Hollywood gossip, which she did, but she was also an extremely good journalist, and she would pursue a story to its complete ending. And that may have been, what's led to her death. Now, she was also good friends with Marilyn Monroe, who also had sort of an untimely, mysterious death. And there are rumors that Marilyn shared information with Kilgallen in relation to her affairs with the Kennedy brothers.
Well, I know she shared something with a screenwriter in Mexico City, which she said that Robert Kennedy had told her all of these incredible things about UFOs, and she wanted to go down to Mexico City and talk about it, but she died shortly thereafter.
Yeah. But the story kind of, got even more and more sort of sinister, if you like, the further that she got into the story itself. And and as you mentioned, Jack Ruby, she was actually the last person to do a sort of formal journalistic interview with Jack Ruby before he died. And it was during this same period that Kilgallen actually confided in her hairdresser, a guy named Mark Sinclair, and she told him that her life had been threatened. And this was actually leading up to what turned out to be her death, which was on November the 8th, 1965. Now, again, we don't know the circumstances of how she died, some people who are skeptical of the idea that she was murdered have suggested that, well, you know, she'd been drinking and she'd had pills and she just died in her sleep. But what we know is that just a few hours before she was found dead, she actually had a meeting in a bar with a guy who nobody's ever been able to identify, but it was supposedly somebody who was going to be there to share some information that would help her. And obviously, the reality of the situation was that, or the inference was that possibly whoever this person was had slipped something into her drink and she passed away in her sleep in that way. And such a thing, you know, is not impossible. There are chemicals and substances which can mimic, you know, the effects of a fatal heart attack, rather than, you know, looking sinister.
Well, tell us about the rumor about the manuscript and the friend.
Well, yeah, there's this story which hasn't been overly investigated because there isn't really too much data, but it does add to the story. And supposedly, Kilgallen, after meeting Ruby, headed off to home and with this mysterious manuscript. And I say mysterious because we're not entirely sure what it contained and who put it together, whether it was her manuscript, because she was planning on writing a book about all her experiences in the investigation of JFK's death. But there are also rumors that there may have been sort of extracts from some of Ruby's own writings, which could have implicated even more people. So that part of the story definitely requires further research, because it could be, you know, one of the key issues that could open doors even, you know, close to 60 years after the assassination occurred of Kennedy.
Somebody should really look into that, the issue of that manuscript and what happened to it, because she allegedly gave it to a friend who then died a few days later, rather mysteriously, and the manuscript was never found again.
Yeah, that's the one thing we know for sure, is that there was a manuscript and then there wasn't a manuscript. It's kind of like with Marilyn Monroe's Diary of Secrets, as she called it. And, you know, there are a number of people who saw it in the immediate aftermath of her death in the local police station. And then suddenly nobody had seen it again. You know, it was just there one minute, gone the next minute.
Okay, well, when we come back, we're going to talk about Marilyn Monroe, and we're moving toward the Kennedy assassination, obviously, in a kind of roundabout way, setting the stage. We're going to be talking about that in a pretty new way, because what has happened with this book is Nick has put together a lot of pieces of a lot of different assassinations, and this an awful lot of stuff in this world that just does not add up. And we're going to try to add it up a little more, because as time passes and we see a longer and longer perspective, we realize, for example, that there's a big pattern here. The assassination of JFK, the assassination of RFK, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of John Lennon, all of these people were taken out, and they changed their removal changed our world in ways that I don't think we should be too happy with. So was there some kind of larger plan behind all of this? We'll see what Nick has to say. Free Dreamlanders, we'll be right back.
Listen to some words from one of our longtime subscribers.
As a subscriber of Dreamland for many years, it's been an incredible adventure and truly a Rosetta Stone for so many of the experiences that all of your listeners have had. Please join us. It's a fantastic ride. But I will say that certainly Dreamland does reflect something that I've always known. that man's mind mirrors a universe that mirrors man's mind. And no other place will you get this truth than on Dreamland. Come join us.
Not too many shows get endorsements like that from people who have been with us for years. Join us. Join the fun. Join the adventure. Join the exploration. $4.95 a month, $39.50 a year, 6 month and 3 month subscriptions too. Go to unknowncountry.com, click on the subscribe tab on the upper right, and get aboard. You will not be sorry. It's a great experience to be part of this community. We're talking to Nick Redfern. His new book, Assassinations, The Plots, Politics, and Powers Behind History-Changing Murders. Now, Marilyn Monroe was a lover of both Kennedys at some point, wasn't he? Wasn't
yes.
Both RFK and JFK. Was there a rivalry between the two men over Marilyn Monroe?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't think there was too much from their perspective, but, you know, Marilyn was someone who was sort of a deeply emotional person. And, you know, I think she fell for both of them, you know, in varying ways. But when she was kind of ignored, and then it became clear that they wanted to distance themselves from her, you know, that kind of crushed her, really. You know, but it was one sort of tragedy on another tragedy, you know, that that led to her death. And in August 1962. And you made a good point, you know, when you mentioned about how, you know, RFK, MLK, JFK, John Lennon, you know, is there sort of a connection between all of these? And I think the connection is the one that you actually mentioned, is that these assassinations actually altered history. And very rarely, you know, are people assassinated for no reason. It's usually for a very big reason. You know, Kennedy, I mean, the fact that he was assassinated, you know, changed history because of all his plans that he had, you know, in the future and trying to, you know, sort of become friends to the extent that they could in the Cold War with the Russians, you know, and the Vietnam War and things like that. So I think we can make a case that a lot of these assassinations are interlinked, whether it's Dorothy Kilgallen, you know, Marilyn Monroe, who happened to be a good friends of Dorothy Kilgallen. And then you've got Marilyn Monroe having her Diary of Secrets, which is rumored to have contained huge amounts of data on JFK and stories that he told her to try and entice her into the bedroom and so on. So all of these people, you know, it's kind of like putting the pieces of a jigsaw together and realizing that these are not random pieces in the jigsaw. They're actually something that when you dig further and further, the jigsaw becomes one large assassination, if you like.
I wonder if there could be a UFO connection with regard to Marilyn Monroe, because there were rumors that she had told people that, I believe, Robert Kennedy had told her some extraordinary things about some extraordinary UFO secrets. Did you hear any of that?
Well, there's sort of one primary source for that material, and this is a document that surfaced in 1995 from a guy named Milo Spiriglio. And Spiriglio, he's dead now, but he wrote three books on Marilyn's death. And in 1995, he held a press conference in California, in L.A., to basically say that he'd got his hands on this one-page document that suggested that Marilyn Monroe knew a great deal about secrets like UFOs, what the plans were for Russia, attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro, things like this. And, of course, the UFO angle was the one that really stood out. And he talks about how Monroe, Dorothy Kilgallen, and several of other of their friends were all being listened to and spied on by the intelligence community. Now, it's a very controversial document, and it's never been declassified officially, but we do know that the typeface of the typewriter that was used to make or to create that document was a 1960s era typewriter. So, you know, that's interesting. But what's sort of more intriguing is that if you read the document, it actually doesn't even mention aliens or UFOs. It talks about things coming from space and dead bodies. Those are actually the words that have been used. Now, my view is that this document is not one that we should dismiss, and I'll explain what I mean by that. A lot of people have said, you know, the document talks about aliens and UFOs. It actually doesn't mention the words extraterrestrials or UFOs or aliens anywhere. It talks about things from space and dead bodies. Those are the literal words. Now, if this was just the work of an enterprising hoaxer, I think they would have been more specific about talking about the UFO angle and really emphasizing it. But by using the terms dead bodies and things from space, you know, that leaves it kind of vague. And hoaxers rarely do that. They rarely, you know, sort of have an air of vagueness to it because they want to really promote what they're talking about. So I think we can make a case that this was and still is a genuine document. But when you read it, it's clearly a summary of what is arguably a much larger document. In other words, this could have been like a summary for the president or the director of the CIA, but there could have been like a 20, 30, 40 page dossier. And this was just, you know, the summary, because presidents, you know, simply cannot read every document, you know, that comes onto their table. So it's a fascinating document. You know, it is a 1960s era typewriter, and it's put together in a very intriguing way that a normal hoaxer would apply their tactics to.
So we are left thinking that maybe the president and his brother spilled some extremely sensitive secrets to Marilyn Monroe. And that leads me to think that maybe he was planning to spill those same secrets to you and me. Is there any indication of that?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at this sort of triangle of RFK, you know, JFK and Marilyn Monroe, you know, they're all interlinked in varying ways. All three of them, you know, were knowledgeable of significant secrets. The Kennedys, of course, because they were in presidency, and Marilyn because, you know, they basically sort of gave her little tidbits of data and secrets as a means to sort of impress her into the bedroom, so to speak.
Right.
You know, and that could have been part of what the, you know, led to their downfall to a degree, you know, because you know, a lot of people portray or assume that Marilyn Monroe was this sort of, you know, sort of ditzy blonde kind of thing. But she wasn't. You know, she was very clever. And in the 1950s, she actually applied for a visa to go to Russia because she wanted to see if the Soviet Union was really like how it was portrayed in the US media. And in the end, she didn't go. But she did actually apply for a visa. You know, she wanted to see it for herself. And she was very clever, very good memory. And this sort of relates to her so-called Diary of Secrets, as it became known. And there's good evidence that, you know, she obviously just didn't have one diary over the course of, you know, years and years. You would need numerous diaries. But there may have been one that contained all of the JFK and the RFK material. And, of course, you know, for the intelligence community to find out that not only had the Kennedys shared some of the, you know, the government secrets, but she'd put it down in a diary, a journal in her house, that one day possibly could get into the hands to somebody else. You know, that was the big nightmare, that whoever wanted her gone decided, well, yeah, she's got to go.
She knew too much.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with most of these people, I think, whether it's, you know, whether it's James Forrestal, whether it's Marilyn Monroe, you know, Dorothy Kilgallen, I think when people get too close, that's when action's taken. You know, if you've got a theory but you've got no evidence, probably nothing's going to happen to you. You know, you start speaking to 20, 30 people and, you know, getting files and dossiers, that, I think, is when, you know, the line gets tripped, so to speak.
Okay, now we're going to move on to JFK himself, and we're going to, of course, we're going to get into this via a couple of names that aren't so often connected with it, Guy Bannister, Fred Chrisman, and Clay Shaw. Okay, now, here we have a situation where the President of the United States may very well have been planning to release information that it is, that somebody who is not here, who not among us, does not want released, without necessarily knowing that, because there are things presidents are not told. I know this briefing that they get. I haven't seen it, but I know what's in it because I've been consulted about it from time to time over the years. And it does not include the idea that somebody from somewhere else has capabilities in our world of controlling what people think and does not want their secret revealed, does not want their presence revealed. It doesn't have that. He wouldn't have known, therefore, that he was playing with fire. But someone else did. Tell us about those three men. I think we lead into it best with talking about Fred Chrisman.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, Fred Chrisman was a fascinating guy. He was someone who was really mystery surrounded him for his entire life. And the weird thing in relation, the weirdest thing, I should say, in relation to Chrisman was the fact that he was connected to both the UFO controversy and the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, the story itself is a very weird one, because Fred Chrisman was a guy who was connected to both the UFO phenomenon and the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, in 1947, specifically June the 21st, this was 3 days before the famous Kenneth Arnold sighting, what happened was that Fred Chrisman was actually out at Maury Island in Puget Sound, Washington State, with a friend of his and a work colleague named Harold Dahl. And they saw this sort of squadron of classic flying saucers. They were described as circular, but with a hole in the middle. So people described them as being like donut kind of shaped. And these objects, whatever they were flying across the sound, and when suddenly one of them started to vibrate and kind of shake and wobble in the air. It suddenly exploded and showered all this weird debris down into the harbor. And Harold Dahl and Fred Chrisman retrieved some of this material, and because they weren't sure what it was, but clearly whatever these things flying in the sky were, you know, that they had no idea what they were, because this was 3 days before the Arnold encounter. So the term flying saucer didn't even exist on June the 21st, but it certainly did after June the 24th, when Arnold shared his story with the media. Now, what's intriguing is that the Air Force quickly sent out personnel to take some of this debris, whatever it was, for study, and it would have been taken to Wright Field, as it was at the time.
Right.
Today, Wright Patterson,
where one of my uncles worked on in the Air Materiel Command,
that's right,
along with his boss, General Arthur Erickson, or then Colonel.
Yeah. And I say it should have gone to Wright Field because the two guys who came from the Air Force to take the material for study, when they took to the skies and left Puget Sound, their plane caught fire on their way back, and they were killed, and the debris was never found, or at least it was officially never found. Now, we jump forward to the 1960s when Jim Garrison, the district attorney of New Orleans, he was actually, Jim Garrison dug into the story of all the different players in the Kennedy assassination. And one of them who he found was Fred Chrisman. And incredibly, Garrison actually identified Chrisman as the second gunman in the November 22, 63 assassination of Kennedy. So you've got Chrisman at the heart of the beginning of the UFO subject in 47, and then he's down at Dealey Plaza. So we have this situation where we have Fred Chrisman being at the heart of the UFO phenomenon when it began in 1947, and then in 1963 we have the assassination of JFK, and we have the situation with Jim Garrison, the New Orleans district attorney, whose research suggested that Chrisman was actually one of the gunmen at Dealey Plaza, and he identified him as one of three so-called hobos who popped up on a famous photograph, which you can find in many of the assassination books. So we have this situation where you have UFOs and the JFK assassination connected, but there's numerous stories like this. For example, another person who was tied to UFOs and the JFK assassination was Guy Bannister.
And Free Dreamlanders, we're going to talk more about Guy Bannister and get a little deeper into this in just a minute, and then later we're going to be talking about Jim Forrestal and what he may have known and what happened on that day that he leapt or was pushed out of a window. We'll be right back. This is a brief excerpt from an interview with two contactees who had an 11-day close encounter experience and are now willing to speak about it, really, for the first time. To hear their whole interview and many others, subscribe to unknowncountry.com. Here's the excerpt. Did you see the man's face?
Yes. Actually, that one is very clear to me. It was kind of longish, and he didn't look completely human, but because he had very, very thin hair, almost non-existent, but he was young. I believe that it was kind of blonde. And he was very tall, like at least six feet. And he was so thin that he looked kind of strange.
And what happened then?
Well, he wanted me to go with him, or to stay with him. He wanted me to stay with him on the ship. And I'd been married for 6 months, and I wasn't about to go running off to stay on the ship.
Now, surely you want more. You must want more. And there is more. Not only this contactee interview, but many others, many of them just as extraordinary, on unknowncountry.com, plus everything else that we offer, my audio books, the meditations, the talks on the key.
William Henry's wonderful Revelation show in its entire run, Anne Streber's brilliant and magical Mysterious Powers, and so much more. Hours and hours of listening pleasure. Learn from the meditations on the site. Really learn, because they're real and they're valuable. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com right now. Go to unknowncountry.com. Click on the subscribe tab. We are running very low on new subscribers now, and that should not be. It should not be happening. So you do it. You go there and you do it today. We're talking to Nick Redfern. His new book, Assassinations, The Plots, Politics, and Powers Behind History-Changing Murders. And it's really well done. Okay, we'll go on now with Guy Bannister.
Guy Bannister was a fascinating character because he was so mysterious. And he had a lot of fingers in a lot of pies. And in the 1940s and 50s, he was a special agent of the FBI. And when he retired, he set up a private detective agency in New Orleans. And during the latter part of the 1940s, Bannister was actually assigned by J. Edgar Hoover to investigate a number of UFO encounters on behalf of the FBI. And you can actually find Bannister's very own reports on UFOs at the FBI's official website, which is called The Vault. And all of the Bannister pages are available for download in PDF fashion at the FBI's website. And they talk about UFO reports from 1947 through 48, when it was sort of like a really crazy busy time for, you know, for UFO activity. And Bannister clearly had a deep understanding of the phenomenon, because he'd been exposed to it, because he was ordered to investigate so many of these different cases. And as I said, by the 1960s, he was retired from the FBI and set up this private detective agency in New Orleans. Now, on top of that, at one point, he had an association with Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans as well. And we also know that the Bannister knew Chrisman. So you have this connection, admittedly a complicated connection, which puts all of these certain players into the UFO issue. And, of course, you know, Marilyn Monroe, JFK, RFK, you can argue that they were all somehow, you know, victims in varying ways. Even Bannister died under mysterious circumstances when he was due to testify on various aspects of the assassination. So, you know, I think we can make a good case that somehow and somewhere there was a connection between JFK and UFO data and what should be released and what shouldn't be released. But the problem, like so many of these assassinations, is that we have threads, and to get the answers, we need more than just threads, you know.
Yeah, we need more than just threads, and that's all we ever get. Yeah. But, I mean, you get into so many deep, dark places, and for example, the Kennedy assassination could very well have been a kind of general agreement between different forces. The people who didn't want the UFO material revealed, the people who were angry at Kennedy for what happened at No Name Key, the mafia people who had lost enormous amounts of money in Cuba and felt like Kennedy wasn't doing enough to Louis Swearingen, for example, a Waffen SS officer, was involved at No Name Key, and he was openly he was not a Waffen SS officer anymore, obviously, but he was openly challenging toward Kennedy after that happened and thought that Kennedy should be removed from office. And he was a man with extremely sinister connections. At the same time, Alan Dulles had been sidelined and by Kennedy and was effectively running the CIA out of his home. He wasn't. He had been fired. And then when the Warren Commission comes along, who steps forward demanding to be on it but Alan Dulles? And I just believe that Dulles controlled the flow of information into the Warren Commission. And at the same time, my own father, my father's brother-in-law was an official in the Democratic Party of Texas at the time. And before the assassination, my dad telephoned me. I was at school in Maryland and said, Whitley, you're to go down and stay with your aunt and uncle. I had another aunt and uncle in Washington. And I said, well, why, Daddy? And he said, Whitley, will you please just for once do something I ask you to do without giving me an argument? But I was in the middle of my classes and I didn't go. A few days later, the assassination happened. And Dad had been terribly upset before the assassination, my brother tells me. And later, I confronted him with this question. And he said, well, the reason I wanted you to leave, because as I felt like something was going to happen to Kennedy, and the reason I felt that was that he had refused to, John Benn, his brother-in-law, called me and said he had refused to go in an armored car, that he was going to go through the streets in an open car, and I just thought he was going to be killed, and I was right. So, in other words, I can't tell. See where I am here. Now, are we looking at a kind of confluence of different people, all with reasons to kill the president?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is why I think one of the reasons, at least, why we haven't fully resolved what happened with JFK, because, you know, people said, well, it was the CIA, it was the FBI, it was the Russians, it was the Cubans, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It was the mafia. And I think you're right that there were different people with very different agendas, but all who wanted him gone. You know, I mean, there was this sort of situation between RFK and the mob, you know, and then you've got JFK wanting to splinter the CIA, and you know, the Cubans, you know, the faction on Cuba that wanted him gone. So I could almost envisage a scenario where people, powerful people in agencies and organizations that normally would never get together on this occasion may actually have got together and said, okay, we don't have any love for you or you or you, but we all have this same agenda. We want this guy gone. And so I think that might explain why you do see mafia links, Cuban links, Russian links, FBI links, etc. I think the reason why is because there were powerful figures in varying organizations that said, okay, get it done. We don't care how it's done. Let's not put anything down to paper and just let us know when it's going to be done and when it's over. And I think that could explain the, you know, the controversies to surrounding how there could be so many different agencies and organizations involved.
And here comes Dorothy Kilgallen, and she puts it all together. She weaves it all together. And I think that what you have just said, those words, are probably what got her killed. I think that she put the whole thing together in her manuscript, which existed, which was given to a friend, and disappeared along with a friend. So I think that basically what we were seeing here is a confluence of conspiracies that led to the death of a president. Now I want to go on into the murders of RFK, John Lennon, and Martin Luther King, and the way the totality of these murders changed our country and our world. Because afterwards, We get virulent anti-communists in the White House. We get a whole different atmosphere. The secret government becomes huge beyond anything anyone could conceive of before. And the national security state becomes the only state. And here we are, sitting here in this country now, infected with a virus which is going to lead us to even more deterioration of our precious freedoms in order to save ourselves. Now, I see a trajectory, and I see in these three men, in these four men, excuse me, a shared love of human freedom, peace, and justice. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. I mean, I think, again, you know, you look at the strands going from JFK to Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and John Lennon, all of them in their own ways, but arguably in very different ways, had the ability to not just change things, but have a lot of people listen to them. And I think it's very often, it's when you have someone speaking to a lot of people on a controversial issue, that's when it can become dangerous. You know, you could find, there could be somebody who, you know, has written a really good book on the Kennedy assassination, which puts it all together, but it only sells 50 copies. Nobody's probably going to care. But when you've got thousands or possibly millions of people hanging on the words of a powerful figure on TV, that, I think, is when the problems begin. And I think, you know, when you look at it, Kennedy's killed, JF Kennedy is killed, Robert Kennedy is killed, Martin Luther King is killed, John Lennon is murdered. And what you have is a situation where people are being killed when they're trying to achieve good ways for the future, you know.
Right, a future that might have been very, very different from the one we are living in.
Yeah.
Which is a dark time and place indeed, and just seems to get darker every day.
Yes, it does. And I think, for me, you know, you can actually combine all of these four deaths, you know, from the 60s to 1980 with John Lennon's death. I think you can make a good case that this may well have been sort of an ongoing program, you know, that anybody who kind of goes against the official grain, so to speak, and doesn't stop and gets more and more followers, and then somebody says, okay, that's another one we've got to get rid of, you know. Now, as to who's doing all of this, that's the big question. I think, you know, a lot of it is sort of done, I don't want to say by secret societies, that kind of gets sort of, you know, overly conspiratorial. But I think, you know, when people think, oh, the government did this or the government did that, I think very often, you know, it's sort of shadowy, powerful figures in ancient money, you know, ancient families, powerful organizations. I think a lot of it is done that way rather than, you know, send out Agent Smith to do this or that. You know, I think it's far deeper and more mysterious than that, you know.
You know, I'm not going to go into detail or name names, but a photographer I know, a famous photographer, once had the wife of a vice president in his studio making a portrait of her, as he has many, many public figures, including presidents and vice presidents and so forth. And she whispered to him, she knew that he knew me, and she whispered to him, "We're trapped. We're trapped." And then the day went on as if it had never been said, and he and I have speculated endlessly about what. Not endlessly. We've speculated a little bit. Not endlessly at all. There's nothing endless to speculate about. What she may have meant. And that we're coming to the end of the free part of Dreamland, and we're going on now into the deeper stuff, the stuff about James Forrestal and all of the things that went down there, and what appears to me to be a spectacularly effective method or effort to control the direction of human society and the human mind. But by whom? Get a little insight into that. The book, Assassinations, the Plots, Politics, and Powers Behind History-Changing Murders by Nick Redfern. It's a wow. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much for being with us. Subscribers, fasten your seatbelts. We are going to have a bumpy ride.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.